Welcome, and thank you so much for tuning into the season premiere episode of season 10 of Maryland's Most Notorious Murders, where the most gruesome, the most bizarre, the most high-profile homicides occurring in Maryland, they are discussed, they are examined, and they are profiled. Can y'all believe that we are in season 10? Wow, I mean, for season 10, I'm not going to lie, y'all, I have to add a legal disclaimer. 95% of this material that is obtained from online public record and or articles that are obtained or collected from the news media online, including mainly the Baltimore Sun, the Daily Record, Fox 45 News, etc., etc. In some cases, the actual participants, they were contacted for their input or version of the story. In some cases, the participants responded, and in other cases, input was included. Their input, their responses was included in their case profile or case episodes. If the participants did not respond to the request for interviews, then the information obtained from the episode was obtained mainly off of public record. Now, can y'all believe that we are in season 10? Season 10, y'all. And we have profiled and examined some of the most bizarre and high-profile homicides occurring in the state of Maryland that have gained national attention for its brutality, for its scandal, and for its notoriety. As a collector of true crime, so to speak, or a seasoned true crime fanatic as I am, throughout the years, I have kept a mental database, so to speak, or a mental data bank of some of the most horrific and well-known homicides that have crossed my radar throughout my lifetime. And the state of Maryland, we do see a lot of homicides, and each season of Maryland's Most Notorious Murders, it focused on just one main common theme or one main motive. And in past seasons, the focus has been on teen killers, murders with a robbery theme, or even murder-suicide cases. So what do you think the focus will be for this season? Season 10. Now, you know, when I was a lot younger, from a very young age, I would say around, 9, 10, 11, 12, I knew that I wanted to work with or do something or basically to have a career in criminal justice, like law enforcement. I did not want to be what most young girls my age wanted to be, like, you know, a nurse, a secretary, a teacher, or something like that. You know, most girls my age back then, in the 70s, 80s, I'm saying my age here, but you know, they wanted to grow up to be like, you know, a secretary or a nurse or a housewife or, you know, something like that. Not me. I mean, I was weird. I saw myself as like Jodie Foster's character in Silence of the Lambs. If y'all ever seen that movie, that's who I wanted to be like. I mean, I had to get up and close and personal with criminals and the criminal mind, the criminal justice system. Like, I wanted to see what prison reform could do. I just had an interest in trying to figure out how to get criminals reformed and how to get bad people to change their lives and change their way of thinking and stuff like that. I don't know why I was fascinated with that stuff at a young age, but that's what my interest lied in as a kid. And like, in order to really have a real career in that, in law enforcement or, you know, that criminal justice background, most people do take the route of becoming a police officer. Now, respectfully, I've never wanted to be a police officer, especially not in the city of Baltimore. In my opinion, being a police officer is one of the most dangerous jobs in the world. And I can't understand why anyone would want to become a cop, especially in the city of Baltimore. I'm not knocking it for anybody that's one, you know, a police officer, but riding around or patrolling the highways of Maryland or patrolling the prisons that we have in this state, that ain't no better. And in the state of Maryland, law enforcement officials can be a target just by wearing that badge, just by having on their uniform. So for this season, season 10, the focus is on any high-profile law enforcement-related type of homicides. Now, this can include murders committed on any law enforcement official or any murders that were committed by any law enforcement official. And when I say law enforcement officials, for this season, I'm referring to police officers, I'm referring to state troopers, and I'm referring to correctional officers. So now that I got all of that out of the way, including the legal disclaimer, the very first case of notorious law enforcement homicides occurring in Maryland that I am going to profile is the brazen and the bold murder of Corporal Theodore Dennis Wolfe Sr. And because this is a podcast that focuses on the most high-profile homicides occurring in Maryland, to be fair, this podcast also has a huge, huge goal in assisting with any unsolved homicide that needs a second look or special attention, because the case is now considered a cold case. And this episode's unsolved homicide that will be profiled is the unsolved shooting murder of 19-year-old Nana Mensah. Now, this next case, although this murder occurred more than 30 years ago, like I said, I was a nerd back then. I was fascinated by crime and homicides and stuff like that occurring in Maryland, or occurring all over, really. But I can still clearly remember this case. I remember the brutality. I remember how cruel it was. I remember the location. I remember the killer crying like a bitch when it was his time to fight for his life. And I remember thinking, even then, like, wow. Just wow. And you wonder why, you know, I don't want to be a police officer. I don't want to be a cop. I don't want anything to do with law enforcement. You can be a cop. You can be a state trooper. It's damn near the same thing. But you can be a police officer or a state trooper for years and years and never have any run-ins with the law. You can never have any issues where you have to pull out your weapon or nobody knowing anything. You could basically live your career as a regular 9-to-5 or whatever throughout your whole entire law enforcement career and never have any issues with anybody. And then on one random day, you get up, you go to work like you normally do, and the life that you knew is over in a split second. The next time you're driving on I-95 close to the I-75 overpass and you see the sign dedicated to Corporal Theodore Dennis Wolfe Sr., I want y'all to remember this story and why that sign is there. Corporal Theodore Dennis Wolfe Sr. always wanted to have a career in law enforcement. And in January of 1974, Theodore started training at the Maryland State Police Academy as a member of the 72nd Trooper Candidate Class, and Theodore was assigned to the Waterloo Barrack in Jessup. A member of the Maryland State Police softball team and earning plenty of awards and certifications along his 16-year career as a state trooper, many, many of Theodore's co-workers and classmates remember Theodore as being one of the most athletic pre-recruits that they had ever seen while training to become a state trooper. Some of the many commendations, awards, and accolades that Theodore had received throughout his career was Trooper of the Year. He received a life-saving award, Maryland State Police Alumni Association Trooper of the Year, Maryland Law Enforcement Officer Association Police Officer of the Year, and multiple Employee of the Month awards. And in February of 1990, Theodore was nominated for Baltimore's Evening Sun Police Officer of the Year award. The award ceremony was held on March 25th, 1990, and Theodore had been in attendance at the ceremony. Just 4 days after the award ceremony, 40-year-old Theodore's life was forever changed in a simple traffic stop on Interstate 95 South in Howard County. March 29th, 1990. Theodore wasn't even supposed to be working that day. It was Theodore's day off, but since he had been in the process of training a new state trooper, and that new state trooper would be patrolling on his own for the first time that night, Theodore decided to come into work to make sure everything went smoothly for the new state trooper. In the wee hours of the morning, Theodore was on patrol riding through I-95 South near Route 175 when he saw a light blue Chevy Nova speeding down the highway. Clocked at dawn 72.3 miles an hour in a 55 mile per hour speed zone, Theodore put on his lights and pulled up behind the speeding car. The Chevy slowed down a little before finally coming to a stop along the I-75 overpass. Behind the wheel of the speeding car was 27-year-old Eric Joseph Torrado and his companion in the passenger seat, 21-year-old Francisco Rodriguez. Eric was a petty New York City Police Academy dropout reject from the Bronx, New York, who had turned to a life of crime and drug distribution. Just 9 days before Eric got pulled over by Corporal Theodore, on March the 20th, 1990, both Eric and Francisco had stood in front of a judge and pled guilty to assault and handgun charges related to three separate earlier crimes that the pair had committed in February of 1989. When they both had stood in front of the judge, then a New York State's attorney had asked the judge that they both be held without bail until they are sentenced because of the nature of the crime. But because the New York jail was already overcrowded, a judge issued bail for them, and after they posted $3,500 in bail, Eric and Francisco was released from a Bronx, New York detention center. After being released from jail in New York on bail, Eric and Francisco went right back to what they knew best, and that was moving drugs. So, using stolen cars, the blue Chevy that they stole in Alexandria, Virginia, they made it from New York to Maryland, where they picked up a shipment of drugs. After making the drug deal, the two headed back to New York in the same stolen Chevy. The stolen car had not been reported stolen just yet, and Theodore had no idea that none of this was going on, and he had no idea that he was about to approach two men who were in a stolen vehicle. As Theodore got out of his patrol car and walked over to the Chevy that had pulled over to the side of the beltway, he had no idea of what was being discussed in the Chevy between Francisco and Eric. According to articles in the Baltimore Sun, Eric and Francisco had already discussed, even then, even before Theodore even walked over to the car, they were discussing even then that they were going to kill the state trooper, because since the car was stolen, that would still eventually link them both to this traffic stop. So in a matter of minutes, both Eric and Francisco decided that the state trooper needed to die, and the only problem was which one of them were going to do it. Eric solved that problem by telling Francisco, "I'll do it." And Francisco handed Eric a loaded .357 Magnum that Eric put in the front of his pants. When Theodore walked up to the Chevy and asked Eric, who was, sitting behind the driver's seat, for his license and registration, Eric handed the state trooper some, like, his documents. Now, mind you, I said the car wasn't even reported stolen yet. So there was no record of it even being stolen. All Theodore was going to do was write them a warning speeding citation and send these two dudes on their merry way. There are two versions of what happened next. One version is that when Theodore got Eric's license, Theodore went back to his patrol car to prepare to write them a warning. And when he went back to his car, Eric approached Theodore, told the state trooper that he himself was a former police officer. And after he showed Theodore his law enforcement credentials, after he showed them to Theodore for approval, then Theodore supposedly let Eric in the passenger side of his patrol car. Then there's another version that says that Theodore ordered both Eric and Francisco to come to his patrol car, and when they did, Eric got in the front passenger seat and Francisco sat in the back seat. Theodore reportedly told Francisco to go close the door of the Chevy, and when he got out of the patrol car to close the door of the car he was driving in, the state trooper had asked Francisco, "Hey, what are you doing? Where are you going?" "No, not that door." Then Eric pulled out the gun and shot the state trooper. Either way, Eric was able to get inside of the trooper's patrol car, and when he did and saw that Theodore was about to issue him a warning for speeding, Eric pulled out his .357 and shot Theodore in his jaw at point-blank range. The bullet traveled through the state trooper's head and landed on the armrest of the car. And, with Theodore still being alive, Eric said because he didn't see where the bullet came out at, Eric put the barrel of the gun in the state trooper's mouth and pulled the trigger, killing the state trooper instantly. I mean, how cold and brutal is that? After taking Theodore's life, Eric grabbed Theodore's ticket warning book, got out of the trooper's patrol car, walked over to the stolen Chevy, and left with Francisco. The two sped off, turned onto 695 heading to Hollins Ferry Road in Baltimore County, where they abandoned the stolen Chevy behind a convenience store about 8 miles away in Lansdowne. They got rid of the gun and tried to burn the state trooper's ticket book to destroy and get rid of any written evidence that would link them to the state trooper's murder. Then, because Eric and Francisco had ran out of money and had no way to get back home to the Bronx, they started making calls to friends and family for them to Western Union them some money so they can get back home. Friends did agree to wire them about $550 that was sent to a location in Baltimore. So Eric and Francisco, they headed to Bmore. They picked up the money orders and headed home to New York like nothing happened. And when Eric got back home to the Bronx, he immediately started bragging about shooting the state trooper to at least one of his friends. Meanwhile, back in Maryland, on the same night that the state trooper was shot and killed, around 4 a.m., a Washington, D.C. Metropolitan police officer who was off duty at the time was driving on I-95 and he saw the state trooper's patrol car parked on the shoulder of the highway with his emergency lights on. No other cars were around that patrol car, which the D.C. officer thought was suspicious. So the D.C. officer, he pulled up to the first patrol car to investigate what was going on. And when he looked inside the car, he saw Theodore on the front seat of the vehicle with blood everywhere. The D.C. officer called 911 for help. And when EMS showed up, which is, you know, emergency personnel, when they showed up, Theodore was pronounced dead at the scene. Theodore had been a Maryland state trooper for 16 years, fulfilling a dream, and he left behind a wife of 19 years and 3 children to grieve. Shortly after Theodore's body was found, about an hour later, around 5:15 a.m., Baltimore County Police responded to a call about a suspected stolen car, which was the stolen Chevy, and it had been found behind the convenience store in Healthrop. And when the police searched the car, they found blood on the inside of that car, too. They found blood droppings was on the inside and outside of the car. And more importantly, the police also found parts of the ticket book that Eric and Francisco had tried to burn, like right on the ground about 10 feet and about 10 feet away in front of the car. Now, that paper, it just hadn't burned all the way up. And it was detectives can easily put that together and see who Theodore was about to write the ticket for. And that's how God works right there. Trust me. Of course, the police ran DNA and fingerprint tests on the stolen Chevy. And guess who fingerprints was all on the car? Soon after that, both Eric and Francisco were found in New York. They were arrested and charged in Maryland with first-degree felony murder, using a handgun in commission of a crime, and illegal handgun possession. They were held without bond or bail. Prosecutors sought the death penalty for Eric, who was the shooter. And a Howard County jury of 7 men and 5 women deliberated for 8 hours whether or not Eric should die for ruthlessly killing the state trooper, or whether he should just have life without the possibility of parole in prison. When asked if he had anything to say before he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility for parole or face the death penalty, Eric cried like a baby, y'all. I'm telling you, literally. And said in his words, these were his words, he was like, "I don't want to die. I ask you, I beg you, please don't sentence me to death. I'm not a bad person. I'm sorry, deeply sorry for all the pain I caused. I don't want to put my family through the pain. All I can say is I'm sorry. Oh God, help me." Can y'all imagine this? Now, Theodore's wife also gave a statement for the jury to consider before Eric was sentenced. In her words, Theodore's wife said to the jury, "I have lost my best friend and confidant, a father of my children, and my emotional security blanket. In fact, I have lost a better part of myself. I wonder if I will be able to look forward to happy events in the future without having them overshadowed by sadness from the past. How will I survive my son's graduations and weddings and grandchildren without Ted there to share my happiness and pride when I still cannot face celebrating even a single holiday at home?" In the end, Eric's crocodile tears worked, basically, and he showed no emotion as he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility for parole. Francisco accepted a plea deal of life in prison with all but 15 years suspended, and when given the chance, Francisco did show remorse for the state trooper's murder when he said in his words, "I am very sorry for the pain that I have caused." Now, Francisco has since been paroled and released from prison for this crime. Wow. This man shot a cop in the face twice and lived. Unfreaking believable. He shot him point blank range at that. I remember, like I said in the beginning when I started profiling this case, I'm not gonna lie, I remember this case clearly. I remember there was a video of Eric crying in front of the judge, you know, him shackled and him just basically crying like a baby because he was scared of that death penalty, y'all. I'm telling you the truth. You should see, like, the tantrum that he showed before he got sentenced. The video is on YouTube, and I believe, honestly, his tears, his crocodile tears and all of that, I believe that's what saved him from the death penalty. I believe that's what swayed the jury a little bit, and they was just like, "All right, you know what, forget it." You know, I don't know how and why anybody who shoots a cop, especially a state trooper, in a state that they're not even from, like, especially just traveling through, I don't know how you expect to get away with that. I mean, how can you not think that you're not going to get caught? How can you do something so bold and then think that, you know, "Oh, I'm just going to ride off into the sunset," and don't think that they're going to call them boys to look for you? That's amazing to me. I literally think of this story and this case every time I'm on I-95. Every time I see the sign, I definitely remember the case of Corporal Theodore Wolf, because I remember the brutality of it. I remember the case about, you know, him being shot in the face. You know, I was just like, wow, this is unbelievable. If y'all thought the 2000s was bad, crimes back in the 90s, especially towards police officers, was off the hook in Maryland. So, like I said, this case was selected as one of Maryland's most notorious law enforcement homicides occurring in the state of Maryland. Moving right on into this episode's unsolved homicide, but before I do, let me say this. This is a podcast that does focus on high-profile homicides occurring in the state of Maryland, and I do realize that a lot of attention, a lot of focus is placed on homicides that may have received a lot of attention, a lot of press, and a lot of notoriety. They might have been featured on Murder, Inc. or Fox 45, WBAL, and all of that. On the flip side, this podcast also has a goal, a major, major goal, in assisting with lesser-known homicides occurring in this state. These type of homicides that did not receive the level or press of notoriety or attention that they deserved and that they should have. It's like 1 minute the victim was here, you may have heard a glimpse about it or something, and then the next minute they weren't here no more. And it's a shame that the friends and or family of the victim is left to just pick up where they left off. They're expected to just move on with their life like nothing happened and just go on living with huge gaping holes in their heart. This portion of this podcast, it shines a light on all these forgotten homicides. It's giving a voice to their voice that's now silent. And on this episode's Unsolved Homicide, this episode's homicide is the shooting murder of 19-year-old Nana Mensah. According to Wikipedia, the Southwest Bemore neighborhood of Irvington is located in Yale Heights, not to be confused with O'Donnell or Park Heights. Like, it's a big-ass difference between Yale Heights, O'Donnell Heights, and Park Heights, trust me. And Yale Heights, it's home to three big-ass cemeteries. There's Loudon Park Cemetery, there's Mount Oliver Cemetery, and there's New Cathedral Cemetery. Irvington houses the communities of Beachfield, parts of the village, I guess, if you want to consider that the village. It's considered located in Baltimore City. The neighborhood of Irvington served as the scene of a senseless homicide during late September in the year of 2012. 19-year-old Nana Mensah had been sitting in the passenger seat in a parked car on Thursday, September 27, 2012, in the 400 block of South Augusta Avenue, when all of a sudden, a gunshot that had been fired from blocks away crashed through the passenger side and struck Nana in the head. Nana was rushed to the University of Maryland shock trauma, but she was pronounced dead at 9:45 p.m. Nana was from Randallstown, and detectives aren't sure if she was the intended target. They're not sure if she was the intended target of the shooting or if Nana was just a random victim caught in a crossfire. And in Bemore, it could be either or. Detectives have been looking for a two-door gray Honda with tinted windows and Chesapeake Bay tags. So, if you have any information to provide in this tragic unsolved homicide, do the right thing. Clear your conscience. Please call 410-396-2100 or 1-866-7-LOCKUP, which is also known as Metro Crime Stoppers. Once again, those two numbers are Metro Crime Stoppers at 1-866-7-LOCKUP or you can call Baltimore City Cold Case Squad at 410-410-396-2100. I remember at one time I had this number speed dial into my phone. Whew. Thank you for tuning in this week. Before I go into my usual routine of how you can access prior episodes, let me mention that if you tuned into me at all the last few seasons, I did tell my listeners that I was producing a true crime documentary that was based off of my very first episode, the episode that profiled accused child killers Adon Canella and Policarpio Espinoza. And yes, the documentary is now currently available because of the extreme graphic nature of the documentary involving the brutal and horrific beheading murders of three innocent children. Networks kind of shied away from me, you know, told me that the doc was too graphic, too much for network TV, even too harsh for YouTube. I mean, I guess because the documentary does include the actual crime scene photos and it includes that information that they probably don't want the public to hear. I mean, I refuse to pull these photos from the documentary because the brutal nature of the crime scene photos, to me, they add to the emphasis of the innocence of Adon Canella and Policarpio Espinoza. In order to fully emphasize the fact that these two individuals did not commit this horrible homicide, I had to show what was done to these kids with no sugarcoating, no cut cards, no bullshit. I mean, there's no way that the victim's uncle and cousins convicted, or the ones that, there's no way they committed these murders that were some of the most brutal murders, child murders, that B-More has ever seen. Either way, the documentary is available via email only, via a WeTransfer link, and I do admit that the documentary is not for everybody's eyes, and this documentary was not produced to make money or to get likes or followers or anything like that, which is another reason why I didn't choose the typical network route. I cannot, I will not, and I won't be censored, especially when it comes to true crime and facts about an injustice that I believe is currently going on. So in order to see the documentary, please visit my website at marylandsmostnotoriousmurders.com, and Maryland is spelled M-D-S. It's abbreviated. You can subscribe to the mailing list by leaving your email address and specifically sending me a request that you want to see the documentary, and I will email the video to you within 24 hours. I have to warn you, though, don't say I didn't tell you, the video is very graphic, very gruesome, very out there. And as I said, networks told me no, because of its violent and extreme graphic content regarding children. But I believe, you know, to be honest, I truly believe that with the state of the world and like the way that we are now, I believe that nobody cares that these two illegal immigrants are locked up serving life sentences. One of them serving life without parole for crimes that they did not commit. Nobody gives a fuck, to be honest. And that's why I produced a documentary, to open up people's eyes, and people's eyes need to be opened, because this don't make no sense. And while you're at it, please be sure to subscribe to this podcast via Spotify for updates on future spine-tingling, hair-raising, eye-popping episodes. And for paid subscribers, be sure to check out the real, the raw, the uncut, the uncensored version of why I decided to start a true crime podcast. A lot of people think I just woke up one day and just jumped on the bandwagon and said, you know what, I'm going to start a podcast. But nope, that's not even hardly the truth. There is a real therapeutic message to this true crime world of gore and mayhem. And if you click on the episode entitled Why I Do What I Do, you'll understand more about why I'm so weird, so crazy, so fascinated with true crime. And while you're at my website, marylandsmostnotoriousmurders.com, be sure to check out any prior episodes that you may have missed with all of the different seasons that we have focused on, like we focused on murder suicide cases, sick twisted pedophile or sex-related type of homicides, or even parricide murders. You can also find links to all of my true crime books that are loosely related to this podcast, entitled Maryland's Most Notorious Murders, 1990 through 2008, Maryland's Unsolved Homicides, Volume 1, Until I Get Caught, The True Story of a Serial Rapist in Baltimore, which is a book that every woman should read. You can also check me out on Season 1 of Payback, which airs for the TV One Network. You can also check me out on the Oxygen Network for Black Widow Murders, where I profiled Maryland's female serial killer, Josephine Gray. Or you can check me out on TV One's Justice by Any Means, where I also profiled, again, my story, my true crime story. You can see me on TV One's Fatal Attraction, where I profiled North Carolina child murderer Peter Moses. Or you can find me hosting Killer Kids for the Element Network, where I profiled teen killers Sarah Citroni and Jason DeLong, who were also profiled for the Parasite episodes. Or you can check out my latest article for the Crime Project, where I'm also discussing again what led me to developing and producing a true crime podcast. Last but not least, many of my listeners have been messaging me on how they can donate to this podcast. On my website, MarylandsMostNotoriousMurders.com, there is a donate icon on the website where you can contribute via PayPal, via Anchor, via Ko-fi, or the via Buy Me a Coffee icons. Thanks so much for all of your constant support throughout all of the years, whether if it was shown through buying or reading one of my books, or even listening to the end of this podcast. Please, please be sure to tune in next episode, where another gruesome, another high-profile homicide occurring in the state of Maryland, it will be discussed, it will be examined, and it will be profiled on Maryland's Most Notorious Murders. And this has been A Savage Life Production.